As the new year begins, the Ortega regime in Nicaragua accelerates the persecution of Catholics. We talk to a priest who is protecting Nicaraguan exiles as they practice their faith. Confusion and disagreement remain over the Vatican's recent guidance on same-sex blessings. We have the latest developments from our correspondent at the Vatican.
God loves us and he wants to have a relationship with us and he wants us to be in full communion with him. And so an annulment process can help someone do that.
Understanding annulment, a Catholic woman's personal story of healing and an expert's explanation of how it can help other divorced people. And the mission of some women religious to bring the joy of animals to those seeking spiritual growth and formation. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
I hope that the path of dialogue will always be sought to overcome difficulties. Let us pray for Nicaragua today.
Pope Francis begins the new year with a call for an end to the escalating persecution of Catholics in Nicaragua. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. The end of 2023 saw an alarming uptick in arrests and abductions of Catholic priests in Nicaragua, as well as the expulsion of women religious. At the close of the year, two bishops, 15 priests, and two seminarians were in custody. One priest was arrested after he celebrated Mass on New Year's Eve. Others were taken from their parish residences. It's all part of a terror campaign against the Catholic Church in Nicaragua by the government of Daniel Ortega in an apparent attempt to crush dissent and control words spoken from the pulpit. The Vatican is expressing alarm.
I'm following with concern what is happening in Nicaragua, where the bishops and priests have been deprived of their freedom. And I express to them, to their families, and to the entire church in the country, my closeness in prayer.
The Catholic Church has been in outward conflict with the Ortega regime at least since 2018, when protests demanding his ouster erupted around the country. At the time, the Catholic Church opened parishes to protesters fleeing persecution and tried to help mediate a national dialogue. Priests outspoken against Ortega have been forced out of the country or detained. The most prominent of those now imprisoned, Bishop Rolando José Álvarez of Matagalpa. The U.S. State Department says he is being held in isolation and all independent evaluations of his condition have been blocked. Bishop Silvio José Báez, the auxiliary bishop of Managua, who has been living in exile in the United States since 2019, called the Ortega regime tyrants who have a relentless and abiding hatred for the church. In a New Year's message, he appealed to the Catholic Church throughout the world, saying, "We beg you, we ask you to turn your eyes toward Nicaragua. Do not leave us alone. Offer your prayers for your oppressed people and raise your prophetic voice in support of this persecuted church." To discuss the religious persecution of Catholics in Nicaragua, we're joined by Father Marcos Omarriba, the pastor of St. Agatha Catholic Church in Miami, Florida. His parish community is deeply involved in this situation, welcoming many Nicaraguans recently expelled from the country, including several Catholic priests. Father Marcos is himself a native of Nicaragua. Father Marcos, welcome so much for being with us. The steady campaign against the church in Nicaragua has been hard to miss, but for those who have, when did this begin, and what changed in Nicaragua that made the church such a target?
After 2018, when the young people protested against, you know, the mistreatment of their grandparents, they came out on the street and they came out like really asking for justice and asking for human rights. And the protests, you know, kind of stopped Nicaragua functioning. And the people who were in the government did not mind killing, imprisoning, exiling, and disappearing young people. So all these, you know, since there, the church in Nicaragua supported the young people because they defended, you know, the rights of the people to speak up. So this is a couple of years already, and it has been increasing. To my heart, never seen this before in the history of Nicaragua, that our own people, you know, our own brothers and sisters, massacred, you know, my brothers and sisters. And just because they are afraid of losing what is not theirs, get stolen, you know, by the people, and making the country like the little farm, and kidnapping, you know, the will of the people, kidnapping the right of the people, kidnapping, you know, the human rights of the people. And this is what's going on in Nicaragua. In my life, you know, I've been exiled like 43 years. I came in 1980 to the United States. I was 16 years old, and I left because of the same thing. And now, 40 years later, you know, you see this trend again of the same people. And it's because they want people to know that they want them either you are with us, shut up, you're in jail, or you're dead, or we kill you, or you leave the country, you know, and taking also the right of the birthright of citizenship and all that. So this suffering is very like, and I'm telling you, it's like Bishop Baez, and I heard him saying, appealing to the conference, the bishop of all the world, and also like to the governments, to take a look at Nicaragua, because this is really like never seen before. I have never experienced this in history of Nicaragua, the kind of evil and massacre and ill will against their own people.
And you've seen this before in different ways, because you minister to a very diverse community. Your parish, St. Agatha in Miami, has some sort of welcoming center for those escaping the regime, with your personal experience, including Nicaraguan priests who were exiled to the United States just last year. We have video now of a service in which they assisted you at Mass upon their arrival last February. And since then, your church has become the spiritual home for those who have fled or been exiled recently from Nicaragua, just like yourself. Now, these weekly Masses are live-streamed with messages of resilience to those who remain in Nicaragua, pushing back against the Ortega regime. Father, tell us how these priests are doing now, after almost a year in exile.
Well, they really like homesick. You know, it's like they used to minister to their own people. They're great pastors, they're great priests who dedicate themselves to save people. I have here like Father Edwin Roman, who was in Masaya, and he was like kidnapped by them. You know, surrounded the church, cut the electricity, called all the services, because you know he had like a few mothers protesting because their kids were killed and all that. I have Father Juan de Dios Garcia, who was like accused of killing a police. And then I have Bishop Baez, you know, who was like ousted by the government, taken by the Pope to Rome, and then arrived in Miami. And let me tell you, he's been like a voice. At least we're doing something like for Nicaraguans, for our own brothers and sisters. And this place is an oasis for them. Bishop and I, myself as a pastor, come and see every weekend new brothers and sisters arriving, desperate, you know, like without nothing. Thank God there is a base community here that have extended, you know, they have friends, they have cousins, they have relatives, and they have extended help. We have done so many immigration like workshops with the Catholic Legal Services to orient them how to apply for asylum and to collect also their stories as a human right, you know, information so that we can present them. There's a whole realm of things that they have found in St. Agatha, and St. Agatha is open arms to all those, you know, like Cubans, Nicaraguans, Venezuelans that have been suffering the same style of regime. But I tell you, among the three, I have never seen the evil that I've seen in Nicaragua by the Sandinista regime.
Well, I know that we are looking forward to continuing to bring the stories that you are sharing with us now. Really quickly, who from the international community then do you believe can make a difference in putting a stop to the human rights abuses in Nicaragua?
It has to be the United States. You know, United States gotta like put pressure on them. The State Department, you know, just demanding the freedom of Bishop Rolando Alvarez. And what they did? They did a circus. They put him on like a checkup, medical checkup and all this stuff. Like, and that's not the real life that he's living, you know. And I think we all of us, one of the things that the church in Nicaragua is doing, everybody says that probably they're silent, you know, they can't say anything, they can't preach anything, they can't mention the name of Rolando Alvarez or any other one in jail, the priest. But they're using one thing that is powerful to all of us, prayer. We pray at Mass, especially we pray at Mass for the freedom, and especially for the care and for the Lord to sustain the life of these people in jail. So in a way, it's like not only United States, you know, but we should be aware of what's going on in Nicaragua. please open your eyes and see the massacre that is taking place.
As a global church united in prayer, well, we will add our prayers to yours. It's wonderful to be with you, and thank you for your work, Father.
Thank you very much, and thank you for exposing this in EWTN.
Of course.
E non dimentichiamo.
And let's not forget those populations in war. War is folly. War is always a defeat. Let's pray for the people in Palestine, Israel, Ukraine, and many other places where there is war.
In addition to discussing his concern for Nicaragua earlier in the week, this new year, Pope Francis repeated his message of peace during his general audience on Wednesday, calling war madness. But there was an apparent escalation in the Middle East conflict on Tuesday when a drone attack in Lebanon targeted and killed a top Hamas military leader and strategist. The explosion in this Beirut high-rise killed six people, including Saleh al-Aruri. Seen here on the video monitor in 2020, al-Aruri was considered a global terrorist and was linked to several terrorist attacks, hijackings, and kidnappings. Though Israel has not taken responsibility for the drone attack across the border in neighboring Lebanon, al-Aruri was known to be on Israel's hit list. And the worst mass casualty event in Iran in decades, when two suicide bombers killed more than 80 people in the city of Kerman and injured more than 250. Thousands had gathered there to commemorate the fourth anniversary of a U.S. drone strike that killed top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, a revered figure in Iran. On Thursday, the Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack. The Sunni Muslim organization has long targeted the Shiite-majority nation. Despite these many conflicts, the Pope's prayers for peace in war-torn parts of the world continue as the Vatican released the full list of his monthly prayer intentions for 2024. This month, the Pope's Worldwide Prayer Network is asking the faithful to pray for the gift of diversity in the Church, recognizing different charisms within the Christian community. In February, prayers for the terminally ill. In months beyond that, in April, prayers for the dignity of women in every culture. In August, prayers for political leaders to be at the service of their own people for the common good. A list of the Pope's prayer intentions for the full year can be found on our sister online news publication, the Catholic News Agency. The Vatican itself made headlines around the world in the last weeks of 2023 when it released new guidelines on offering blessings for people in irregular relationships, including civilly remarried Catholics and those in same-sex relationships. The document created widespread controversy, with many lay people, priests, and bishops speaking out against it. The Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, or DDF, released Fiducia Supplicans on December 18th. The declaration states that blessings may be given spontaneously to those in irregular situations. However, the document specifies that these blessings are not in the context of a formal liturgical rite. The DDF emphasizes that marriage is the only context that sexual relations find their natural, proper, and full human meaning. In response to the document, Bishop Robert Barron, the chairman of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Laity, Marriage, Family Life, and Youth, emphasizes that the declaration does not constitute a step toward ratification of same-sex marriage, nor compromising the Church's teaching regarding those irregular relationships. He goes on to say Fiducia Supplicans is very much congruent with Pope Francis's long-held conviction that those who do not live up to the full demand of the Church's moral teaching are nevertheless loved and cherished by God and invited to accept the Lord's offer of forgiveness. And there have been developments since the December publication of the document on blessings and the initial response. Jonathan Liddle, senior editor for the National Catholic Register, is here to help get us caught up on the latest. Jonathan, great to have you. For those confused by that initial document released before Christmas, what does it do and what doesn't it do?
Well, let's start with what Fiducia Supplicans doesn't do, because I feel like this is where a lot of the confusion came from. Initial media reports in mainstream media and including also in Catholic progressive media said that this was allowing for the blessing of same-sex unions and relationships. And quite clearly, quite emphatically, that is not what this blessing or not what the document allows for. In fact, it underscores that the Church's teaching on marriage and sexuality is unchanged, and that anything that would cause confusion or scandal about the nature of those things should be avoided and needs to be avoided. What the document does do is it does allow for what it describes as the spontaneous, non-liturgical pastoral blessings. So outside of a formal context, if a same-sex couple or a couple in an irregular relationship seeks a simple blessing for the closeness of the Lord in their life and that they might better conform their lives to his will, this is something that an ordained minister can offer them. The document also makes clear, though, on how this can be done in a way that avoids confusion and scandal. For instance, it says there can't be any kind of prepared text, right? They shouldn't be promoted. It's not a liturgical rite. It also adds, in addition to that, that any use of clothing or symbols or signs associated with marital blessings need to be avoided as well. But even with all of that guidance, and it's a lengthy document, over 5,000 words long, I think a significant point of confusion for many people in its aftermath was, what does it mean to bless a same-sex couple as opposed to two people who might be together in a partnership? And I think a major concern that was raised is that by offering these kinds of blessings, the church would be implicitly condoning the kind of sexual activity, right, that makes two people a couple. So that's been one of the major concerns and points of needed clarification in the aftermath of Fiducia Supplicans.
Absolutely. It needed clarification, and the global response is what signaled that to the church, from bishops and conferences refusing to implement the document to those who offered additional guidance. This was significant because the way that same-sex attracted people are treated around the world is different. Tell us a little bit more about the other clarifying document that was released just this week. What did it do?
That's right. Well, first of all, this is somewhat unprecedented. A press release from the Dicaster of the Doctrine of the Faith, from Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, the prefect of that Vatican office, which came just 2.5 weeks after the initial document, said no further clarification would be guided. But given that pushback that you cited, this new clarification, it did a few things. One, it underscored that bishops in different parts of the world, it is their duty and their responsibility to discern how to prudently implement this guidance in a way that will avoid confusion and scandal. So, of course, throughout many African countries, places in Eastern Europe, but also individual dioceses in Europe, Latin America, and the U.S., bishops have said we're not going to allow these blessings at this time because of the possibility of confusion, or they've mandated that these blessings be done in private to avoid scandal. So the clarification said, yes, this kind of discernment by the local bishop is possible as long as it's not taken as a rejection of the document as a whole. In addition, Cardinal Fernandez also offered a few more clarifications about how these blessings could be done in a way that might allegedly avoid confusion. For instance, he said the blessings need to be very short. He said 10 to 15 seconds, and he underscored that these blessings should not take place in prominent parts of churches. They shouldn't happen in front of altars, which is something that we have actually seen in the aftermath of the document itself. So more words from the Vatican, but still unsure if that will bring the clarification that so many people are looking for.
Well, you say more words, but those aren't actions. Do you think there will be additional developments from the congregation or a statement from Pope Francis? And might this harm the unity and ecumenical dialogue that has been a legacy for this pontificate?
Well, that's certainly the concern among many people throughout the church across the world right now. And I think you're right, Monsi, that the Vatican continue to offer and issue clarified statements and guidance. But a lot of people's concern is if the Vatican and the Dicastery of the Doctrine of the Faith is unwilling to enforce its guidance, that this will lead to widespread confusion about the nature of marriage and sexuality in the church and possible great disunity across the universal church. And in fact, we've already seen some of these abuses in the weeks since Fiducia Supplicans was published. We saw Father James Martin in New York hold a blessing of two friends who are civilly same-sex married. He had the New York Times come and document it. So clearly, in a way that seems inconsistent with the spontaneous, non-planned nature of these blessings. We've also seen church leaders in Germany, where they've been pushing for formalized liturgical blessings of same-sex couples, and also changes to the church teaching on sexuality in the aftermath of this, they've said they don't see this as a stop sign for them, and they're going to continue their push. So really the concern here is that there's a need for action, because if action isn't taken, what we'll see across the church in different places, different dioceses, different countries, is different people implementing it, implementing fiducia supplicans differently. And in some places, it'll give rise to confusion about what the church actually teaches about sexuality and the nature of marriage. And if that isn't managed, some people fear that the stage might be set for the possibility of a schism in the church, if not a formal one, at least one practically speaking.
Well, those are dire consequences. Jonathan, we're going to keep watching this developing story. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Monsi.
Divorced people seeking blessings and full communion within the church. When we return, we explore and explain the process of healing through annulment.
Don't be afraid to speak about, yes, divorce is bad, but annulments are a way to heal and to grow.
One woman's story of divorce, annulment, and reawakening in the church. Planning for the next chapter. The new dean of the School of Theology and Religious Studies at the Catholic University of America shares his vision. Dr. Joseph Capizzi is on the record.
Nuns on a farm. Faith and farming go together here, and the sisters' ministry is bringing hope and healing to others. I'm Mark Irons. That story coming up.
And later, Down on the Farm. We take you to a unique ministry in Wisconsin that integrates animals into the mission. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
In our previous segment, we talked about sacramental blessings and church doctrine that teaches us that marriage is a union of one man and one woman in lifelong fidelity. So when a Catholic marriage ends in divorce, the pain is more than personal. It reaches into one's spiritual identity. That's why annulment can be such an important part of healing for divorced Catholics or divorced people seeking to become Catholic. Rizal Regis helps explain what you need to know about annulments in this Catholic Life report.
My faith grew stronger and stronger, and that's where you learn to rely on Him. And even those little prayers with, like, Jesus, I trust in you. You take care of everything.
Emily Duncan thought she had everything she hoped for in life, a home, a marriage, and two young children. So when her marriage was dissolving and she knew divorce was imminent, she was devastated. For comfort, she turned to Jesus and His church.
I took time to work on myself and talking with therapist and, you know, spiritual advisors, started to get more into adoration and spending time adoring Jesus.
Duncan became more and more involved with her parish. After some time of healing and self-reflection, she felt ready for an annulment and turned to a local priest for guidance.
I had made a commitment to a friend, a spiritual director, who said, you know, Emily, I'll help you through this process and I'll be there with you, but in order, the one thing I ask is if we do this, that no matter what the tribunal, you know, what the annulment process says, that if either you are free to marry or you're free not to remarry, that, you know, you'll accept that and you'll honor that. And I said, yes, absolutely.
The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops states that an annulment of marriage is a Catholic declaration of nullity. Nullity means invalid.
If something in the content of the marriage, the way the church defines it, is missing, or if the ability to place the consent intellectually with freedom and with proper will, if that's missing, then we can say, yep, we see indications, and we'll start the process to investigate that.
Father Paul Hartman has previously served as judicial vicar for the Archdiocese of Milwaukee for more than 20 years and has seen numerous cases for annulment when a marriage did not fit the following criteria. He explains that for a Catholic marriage to be valid, it is required that the spouses are free to marry. They are capable of giving their consent to marry. They freely exchange their consent. In consenting to marry, they have the intention to marry for life, to be faithful to one another, and be open to having and raising children. They intend the good of each other, and their consent is given in the presence of two witnesses and before a properly authorized church minister.
So someone comes to us saying, I want to bring some closure to this part of my life, my past. And I sincerely believe I can make the case that something was missing. And they have to make a petition.
The first step, the petitioner submits written testimony about the marriage and puts together a list of people who are familiar with the marriage.
Find witnesses, find people who were around at the time of the courtship and the marriage and can testify. I saw this, I saw that, I thought this, I thought that, I understood. And so it helps us build the case that something necessary for the bond of marriage to come to bear was missing.
The case then goes to a judge, which is usually the bishop of the diocese. All the materials provided are then investigated, followed by the judgment.
Once the decree is given, and it's not going to be appealed anymore, the parties are free to marry. This is where, while again, I think it's a bit of a misnomer to say the marriage never happened. Well, no, there are usually pictures and there may be children and there are memories. The life event happened, but it wasn't a sacrament, and the bonds that the church expects are not there.
A 2015 Pew Research study found that 43% of divorced Catholics did not seek an annulment because they did not see it as necessary or they did not want to get one. And 49% of American Catholics personally think that getting remarried after a divorce without an annulment is not a sin. Because of these alarming statistics, in 2015, Pope Francis announced sweeping revisions to the annulment process. His aim was to make annulment more accessible and to cut down wait time. For example, annulments need only one judge now instead of a two-tribunal process, and local bishops are now the principal judge for their diocese and can be assisted by others whom they choose.
I would wholeheartedly do it over again.
For Duncan, seeking an annulment was her way of healing and wanting to be in full communion with Christ.
Going through the process of annulment helps us to remain in that state of grace and allows us to receive God worthily and to know where we stand. It's so important because you want to be modeling as a parent, you want to be modeling the faith, right? And that you're seeking out all sacraments.
She thanks her spiritual advisor for helping her navigate the annulment process, which for her took 18 months. Now, several years later, she can say she has everything she has ever hoped for, a loving home and new marriage built on faith, plus welcoming two more beautiful children with her husband.
With us both having that deep faith in God, any of those hiccups allow us to, you know, put each other first and to love the other partner and have a really good understanding of we're helping each other, you know, get to heaven. At the end of the day, our goal is to help get each other to heaven as well as our children.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
If you would like more information about annulment, a good place for guidance is the Office of Marriage and Family Life in your diocese. Next, a significant change in leadership at the Catholic University of America. Our On the Record interview right after this. Welcome back to EWTN News in Depth as we bring you an important discussion with the brand new Dean of the Department of Theology and Religious Studies at the Catholic University of America. Dr. Joseph Capizzi is unique in that he's the first lay leader of the university's theology department in its more than 130-year history. In addition to his academic work, Capizzi is the busy father of six and does service at his parish. Those are life experiences he brings to his position at the only institution of higher education ever founded by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, a position that had to be confirmed by the Vatican. Joe Capizzi shares his vision for his new role. He joins us on the record.
Having so much going on, but also understanding the dynamic of family and service, speak into this new role that you have, Dean of Theology at the Catholic University of America, the premier university, right?
We think of ourselves as the premier Catholic university in this country. We have a very unique service. My family life has always informed my professional life. I'm a moral theologian by training, and, you know, life in a family is constant moral learning. You're trying to instruct your children into the best ways to behave and live their lives, and they're teaching you about your own behavior constantly. And certainly all of that has always informed my own writing, my research, but it's also helped inform or prepare me for this role as dean. I've met, you know, helping manage a household, for one thing, is not dissimilar from managing a faculty. But also just being patient with people, I think, is a critical component of helping lead them as a dean.
When people think about a dean of theology or even the department of theology, they think books, they think boring documents, encyclicals. Not, I mean, maybe not boring, interesting to us. But they don't think about the active evangelizing part of theology. Tell us a little bit about how all of those books then inform what your faculty does to bring Christ to the world.
So what we do in the School of Theology and Religious Studies at Catholic University is try to understand God's Word and communicate that to our students, to all of the people who come into contact with us through events or the sorts of training and formation we might do in ministerial areas. So it's constant preparation for evangelization. And of course, we ourselves as individual faculty, as the dean, are constantly trying to contribute in our unique ways to the evangelization the church is all called to do together. So it's constant reinforcement. It's constantly, even in its academic component, trying to serve how do we communicate God's word in this precise moment, given these circumstances, to the people that are that we come into contact with.
You're the first lay dean of theology at the Catholic University of America. Now, you're not the first lay dean of theology in a Catholic university, but this is particular because it's approved by Pope Francis. Tell us about how this works and why Catholic University has to have certain positions approved by the Holy See.
So we are an ecclesiastical faculty at Catholic University. We have three ecclesiastical schools, the schools of canon law, philosophy, and theology and religious studies, which means essentially we come under the canon law of the church. And according to the canon law of the church, in order for me to be appointed as the dean of the school, I have to get something called the nihil obstat, which essentially means that there's no impediment, there's no block to me being and serving the church in this manner as a dean. To get that, I have to be approved by the Vatican. This goes right to the Congregation for Education. They look at my record, my profile, the publications I've done, the work I've done to form myself as a theologian, and make a judgment whether I'm fit to do this or not. And they made the judgment, yes, I am fit to serve in this role. So it's fantastically important for the church. It also, what a privilege, right? What an honor.
It's a beautiful story, too, to see how Pope Francis's pontificate has really started to bring lay people in. He's appointed lay people to different dicasteries, lay families to different dicasteries to get them to really give us a sense of what the church on the ground feels like. Do you think that this appointment, your appointment, signals some of that as well?
I think it signals a couple of different things. One would be the positive thing, which you just emphasized, right? The sense of the role of the laity, especially right now, in helping evangelize the culture, right? And laity are having to step into, you know, roles that they didn't occupy in the past. And this is a wonderful opportunity. It connects back to, you know, my family, right? Bringing certain kinds of familial experiences into these contexts. So that's great. I think there's also one aspect of it where we as a church should also be thinking there's a little bit of a challenge for us all, and that's just the decline in vocations, right? The overall decline in the numbers of priest scholars, for instance. When I first arrived in the faculty in 1997 at this school, I had, you know, about a quarter of the faculty, quarter of the 45 faculty were priests. That's no longer the case. You know, it's one thing to say this is an intentional thing. It's another if it's just a consequence of demographic changes. So it's a lot to think about in terms of if we're trying to form young people into vocations. This has to happen.
Are you hoping to also use this opportunity to shine a light on some of those great vocations to inspire others to follow in the footsteps of those who would be the great academics, the
Absolutely.
Great vocation academics?
Absolutely. We have this amazing tradition of priest scholars at Catholic University. Fulton Sheen is one of them. Cardinal Avery Dulles was another one of them. John Tracy Ellis was a famous historian. There was Monsignor John Ryan, you know, the New Deal John Ryan, right? There's a kind of long history of Catholic priest scholars impacting the culture. And we don't have that right now. Mm. And I do believe it's a kind of, if we build it, they will come thing.
Do you think that we've made the priesthood overly administrative and not pastoral enough or academic enough where they serve as one part rather than two?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if I would say it's overly this or that. It just is highly administrative. The burdens on priests today are enormous, as you know, right? Anybody who is engaged with the church just sees that our priests are under enormous pressures, and some of those pressures are just administrative and bureaucratic.
What are you nervous about in this role? Were you nervous to have an appointment to be reviewed in this way? It almost feels like a confirmation hearing.
a little bit, but I was confident about what I've done. I was confident about my role. I was confident about the work I've done in the past in terms of research and service to the church and to the university. My nervousness, I think, stems mostly for the future of the church as a whole, just in the sense, of some of the issues we've talked about. Number one, demographic changes in the church, herself. Where are vocations coming from? Can we focus on those areas? Can we focus on areas where we've lost vocations historically that have informed the church? Can we try to reinvigorate those places?
Joe, how are you preparing for this role from a prayer perspective? What's your prayer life like? It's obviously a very different role than the one that you had before at the university.
Right, that's right. Like anybody else, I might think of my prayer life as deficient in some ways. I always think it needs to be better than it is. I have certain saints that I pray to pretty regularly, like Saint Charbel, for instance, is one of my favorite saints. Saint Lucy from Sicily, where my father's family was from, is somebody important to me. But now that I am serving a larger group of people, there's no question that my prayer life is, I can see it transforming, let's put it that way.
So you just mentioned your family is from Sicily.
Yes.
Italian-American
immigrants,
right?
On my father's side, yeah, correct. Immigrants, that's right.
And on your mother's side?
Jewish, in fact. My mother's side is Eastern European Jewish, yeah, so it's interesting, common New York mix, but interesting mix nonetheless.
So there's no way that you haven't studied the spirituality of the immigrant combination that created who you are.
Absolutely.
How does that inform what you think needs to be brought to the Universal Church, the reality that we all have some kind of either spiritual or ethnic Jewish heritage and that we come from different parts into the American church?
Yeah, absolutely. It has informed my approach to these kinds of things. And one thing that I've noticed, for instance, I've really been drawn to the way Pope Francis speaks about these kinds of things, especially to sort of reach out to the peripheries of society, because of course immigrants are out there on the edges. And as you said, most of us come not too long ago from experiences that are like that, where people were on the edges of society. And my father told stories about his own father, getting in and out of work because he had more or less, no standing in the culture. My mother's family's experience was very different, than this, coming out of a kind of persecuted situation in the Eastern European area into the country. So most of us have not too remote contact with these kinds of experiences of vulnerability.
What can we learn from our Eastern brothers and sisters? What is it that's there for us to rediscover as a church, or that your students might not have access to without someone who's interested in breathing with both lungs, as Pope John Paul II says?
Yeah, actually at our school, we are breathing with both lungs. We have the Eastern Christian community and Eastern Catholic communities really well represented in the school. We have faculty who are devoted to that study. We have faculty who engage actively with Eastern Christian churches, both at their homes, whether it's in Egypt or Greece or the Ukraine, just as for instances, but also the diaspora communities of these Christians who have left persecution, right, and come to the United States and found, a much better situation for their faith lives. We have faculty who are engaging those as well. And we draw students consistently from Lebanon and places like that, who want to come study at our university. We are unique in that regard.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Monsang. Thank you so much.
Our prayers and best wishes to Dr. Capizzi as he begins his new leadership role at the Catholic University of America. Up next, news headlines in the Week in Review.
remembering Pope Benedict XVI on the first anniversary of his death. Thousands of young people gather at the Seek 24 conference to pray and celebrate life in fellowship. And the Catholic impact in one African nation Pope Francis visited in 2023 as we look ahead at his 2024 travels.
Honoring the legacy of Pope Benedict XVI, 1 year after his death, tops the Week in Review. The Pope Emeritus died on December 31, 2022, and this week at the Vatican, his life, teaching, and legacy were remembered in a solemn tribute. Pope Benedict's longtime personal secretary, Archbishop Georg Gainswein, presided at Holy Mass at St. Peter's Basilica. And there were conference sessions focusing on Joseph Ratzinger's lasting contributions to Catholic thought, theology, and ecclesiastical life.
But the most enduring contribution Joseph Ratzinger made to the Church and her mission must surely be his many writings on the reform of the post-Vatican II liturgy. Above all, the liturgy of the Eucharist, the very source and summit of the Christian life.
Scholars, experts, and friends of Pope Benedict discussed his impact on church and society, as well as his views on morality and the afterlife. The conference was not only a memorial, but also an exploration of his life, both as an influential theology professor in Germany and later as the head of the Holy See at the Vatican. It may take until 2025 before an appeal in the Vatican financial scandal case is resolved. Six people, including Cardinal Angelo Becciu, were found guilty and sentenced to jail terms in the corruption trial right before Christmas. Becciu retains his apartment at the Vatican and will not serve any time behind bars before or during the appeal, which court observers say is not expected to start before the end of 2024 and could take at least another year to conclude. Becciu is the highest-ranking Vatican official to ever stand trial before a Vatican criminal court. Catholic democracy activist Jimmy Lai pleaded not guilty on Tuesday to all charges laid out against him in Hong Kong. Lai faces charges of conspiring to collude with a foreign power. Chinese authorities arrested the activist in August 2020 under a controversial national security law that sought to crack down on pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. If found guilty, Lai could be sentenced to life in prison. His family is asking for prayers for him and the many members of his former company. Seek and ye shall find. This week, a conference brought thousands of college students together in St. Louis, Missouri, to encounter Christ and community. Organized by the Fellowship of Catholic University Students, the annual SEEK Conference drew young people from around the country. College students spent this week growing in their faith through talks and Eucharistic adoration. For many participants, attending Mass and adoration in an auditorium packed with thousands of their peers is a highlight. It's a reminder that they are not alone on this faith journey.
You feel so alone sometimes when you're practicing your Catholic faith, and you just feel like, you know, you can be secluded in the community, or like you're one out of three, especially when you go away from your Newman Center or your Catholic Center and you're out on campus. But just being here and seeing 20,000, you know, plus students all just celebrating the Mass, saying the prayers, it was just really powerful for me.
Next week on EWTN News In Depth, Mark Irons has a full report from the SEEK conference where he talked to dozens of young people about why they came and what they found. Their faith is deep and it's inspiring. You won't want to miss it. After half a dozen trips last year, Pope Francis shows no sign of slowing down his travels. He's already mentioned three apostolic visits he hopes to make in 2024. The Holy Father has confirmed a stop in Belgium in September in honor of the 600th anniversary of the University of Louvain. And though not confirmed, Pope Francis hopes to visit his home country, Argentina. This would be his first trip home in his decade-long tenure as Pope. The Holy Father has also expressed a desire to visit Polynesia. Despite being one of the oldest popes in church history and dealing with numerous health issues, Pope Francis proved in 2023 he is still a globetrotter. The Holy Father made apostolic visits to six countries, including a joyous stop in Lisbon, Portugal, to celebrate World Youth Day with hundreds of thousands of young Catholics in September. And in 2023, Pope Francis made history by becoming the first pope to visit both Mongolia in Central Asia and South Sudan in East Africa, the youngest country in the world. EWTN News visited South Sudan ahead of the Pope's trip to get a sense of the Catholic Church's work in Africa. That's where a reporter, Colin Flynn, met a Catholic priest who has devoted his missionary life to the people there.
South Sudan, in many ways, it resembles Ireland. South Sudan fought for independence for so many years.
Father John Skinner is a spirit and priest from County Monaghan in Ireland. He's bringing us to a rural area in South Sudan called Barko.
Barko is an area that was very isolated in many ways. There was no school here, no health facilities, and mainly because it was a very violent area. It was an area where people fought a lot over young fellas over cows.
In 2012, the Spiritans entered South Sudan and appealed for peace between the country's various tribes. And they started a mission focused on education.
We were asked by the community here if we could come and help them to get a school established. This is the school now. "Don't drive over my shoes," she's shouting. "Wah, wah, wah."
There's a real feeling of joy from the kids here that they get to go to school. And you can sense a feeling of pride that they're getting an education. And the incredible thing about this school is that it was entirely built from Irish donations.
The school has over 400 pupils. The school is only 3 years old. It was only built 3 years ago. So you will find that some of the students are in the higher classes are all boys, because no girls would be allowed to walk far distances to get to school and that. So now the girls are having an opportunity to go to school, and we see many in the lower classes.
Father John has been working as a missionary in Africa for 40 years, 10 of which have been here in South Sudan. He arrived in 2012, just after the country gained independence.
What was your first reaction, your first impression when you came to Africa?
I suppose the friendliness of the people, the fact that so many people were walking along the road was the first impression, the first thing that struck us in that, yeah. And then, of course, the poverty and... It's probably one of the countries that I've worked in where you feel most needed. Traditionally, the people would have lived in cattle camps with their cows, etc., with no formal education as such. So now that they want formal education, they can't continue the way of life with the cows. They have to move into the whole aspect of agriculture and developing their skills in growing their own food.
It's Sunday morning and Father John is on his way to say Mass in the local church.
The youth see the church as very much to the forefront in regards to education and development. They see the Catholic Church as being a very modern influence in their society.
While in the Northern Hemisphere of the world, the Catholic Church may be declining in numbers, in many parts of the Southern Hemisphere, like South Sudan, the Catholic Church is growing.
There's a great dynamism. And one of the challenges for us is, especially here in the Catholic Church, we have too many young people in the Catholic Church. We have too many youth coming and not enough adults dealing with the youth. Because the adults would have traditionally been more inclined to go, because of the British influence, to the Protestant Church. Whereas the younger generation see that the Catholic Church is more focused on development and more focused on education, and they tend to come to us.
At one stage, there were over 600 Irish spirits and priests across Africa. Today, there are only five. And they're now handing over parishes to local priests and religious.
We have been replaced, as you've seen yourself, by young African missionaries. So the young African priests, the missionaries, the sisters are replacing us. So there's a great dynamism and activity in the church.
In Barco, South Sudan, Colm Flynn for EWTN News in Depth.
Up next, we focus on the work of another unusual mission. Two women religious bringing the joy of animals to help heal those in need.
Devoting yourself entirely to God, giving yourself entirely to God, and working with the animals and the people.
We head to Wisconsin to learn about spiritual formation at a mission known as the Merciful Heart of Jesus Farm. We'll be right back.
It's not often a connection can be drawn between a religious life, a love of animals, and hard manual work down on the farm. But reporter Mark Irons found this unique combination in Wisconsin. Here's this week's Faith Journey in Depth.
Yeah, I know this. Yeah, good.
The horses and barns are named after saints.
O Mary, conceived without sin.
The work days begin and end with prayer, and the farmhands wear religious habits.
Mother will clean the stalls. I'll dump the wheelbarrows.
Nuns on a farm. They don't shy away from the manual labor, but Mother Mary Veronica describes the spiritual nature of their work here, focused on healing and mercy.
The reconciliation of relationships with self, others, and God, and really all creation.
The Franciscan Congregation of Divine Mercy Sisters stand out in bright sacrificial color against the green and brown grounds of their farm in Marshfield, Wisconsin.
He suffered for our sins and laid down his life for us.
Their red habits represent the passion and death of Christ.
We lay down our lives for his people.
And they carry out that mission in a holistic way here at the Merciful Heart of Jesus Farm, welcoming families, integrating spiritual formation, activities, and the animals into their ministry.
Being close to God's creation is certainly important, and to use that in the way God intended to help people grow closer to Him in the beauty, in the goodness.
Stephanie Hanisch visits with her six children.
It taps into that the natural order of God and His creation to be able to come and have that relationship with nature and with the animals.
She says her kids are learning about responsibility by caring for the horses.
My oldest even said that she felt like she had a connection with one of the horses, that the horse understands her.
Mother Mary Veronica says that type of relationship goes both ways, providing valuable lessons.
We try to understand the horse, we try to understand their emotions and respect their emotions. Interacting with the horse this way, we learn to respect the horse, but we also learn to respect ourselves and to respect other people's.
With the horses and dogs, the sisters can also offer animal-assisted therapy. Mother Mary Veronica began to understand how animals can play a role in helping to lead others to spiritual conversion before she made religious vows. As a young woman, her passion was horses. She was a riding instructor, and as her clients spent time with her and the horses, they were developing as more than riders.
They were getting closer to God. You know, I was just being a riding instructor and trying to live the gospel.
Looking back, she says only God could have brought together her love for animals and a divine call to serve others as a sister.
I never would have thought of it in a million years.
But the mission at Merciful Heart of Jesus Farm involves much more than the animals.
No, I don't think it's scary. Oh my goodness.
Arts, crafts, and catechesis are wrapped into programs for children. As Sister Maria Lucia continues her formation, she finds joy in helping them develop their growing faith.
It's beautiful to see how God is working in their hearts. And a lot of times it's not what we do, it's what they bring here.
Other visitors to the farm have come during tough times.
Which was very hard, very devastating.
Rose Anderson suffered after her husband had an affair. But with the help of Mother Mary Veronica and spiritual direction, she has been able to forgive, and her marriage has been restored.
She has saved my family, probably saved my husband's life. I will always be grateful for her.
It's a busy farm and faith-based ministry, but along with all the activity here on this patch of Wisconsin countryside, silent prayer and contemplation. is also a big part of the sisters' lives.
Now and at the hour of our death.
Seeking divine assistance through prayer is even more critical for these sisters, considering it's just the two of them.
It's a challenge with just the two of us to really fulfill the need.
We have some good volunteers who help us, but there's many times we're carrying a big load.
Part of the reason the Franciscan Congregation of Divine Mercy Sisters is so small in number is because they are so new. The congregation was approved as a private association of the Christian faithful with the intent of becoming a religious institute by the bishop in the Diocese of La Crosse, Wisconsin in 2020. Prior to that, founder Mother Mary Veronica was a Franciscan nun. In her discernment, she also felt inspired by St. Faustina, an early 20th century nun who emphasized divine mercy.
Oh my goodness, it just captivated my heart.
So this new community is both Franciscan, recognizing the beauty in creation, and focused on spreading the mercy of God.
How can we be more aware of what others are trying to communicate and not judge them, not put a label on them, but be merciful and listen to them and respect them.
Slowly, more and more people are learning about the spiritual labor of love at this farm. It caught the attention of Mary Grace Bach, who visited the same time we did.
I just love, you know, just everything. Like, you know, having, you know, like being able to like pray with Jesus and whatnot and have all like the prayer time. But then also the animal aspect and like the kids and whatnot, seeing all the kids with the animals.
A prospective sister, she had been at the farm less than 24 hours, but sounded like she was ready to call it home.
I love it. I love it. Like I could literally just like move in now. Like this is where I want to be.
The nuns with the red habits, horses, and deep desire to foster divine healing in a broken world bring a new perspective to life on the farm and living a life of faith.
Their life, giving it all up for God, it is just a beautiful thing.
The takeaway for Sue Mays, a local resident and friend to the sisters, is we could all give a little bit more.
And I think God's trying to shake us up a little bit and say, hey, if the nuns can do that and they can run a farm.
But the sisters are inviting everyone, near and far, to take part in their mission by living the mercy of God in everyday life in small ways. Mother Mary Veronica says it could be a powerful form of prayer.
If we're all united together in this one prayer, and it's so simple, one act of mercy a day.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
What a beautiful message on this Feast of the Epiphany. That's our program for today. I'm Montse Alvarado. EWTN News in Depth returns next week, same time, same place, bringing you more reports important to your Catholic life. See you then. Thank you.